North Korea fired on a South Korean island on Tuesday in an attack that surprised South Koreans and set governments around the world on edge. The artillery barrage killed at least two South Korean Marines and two civilians and injured at least 16 others on Yeonpyeong Island. North Korea reportedly fired 100 artillery shells from a position north of the island. The South responded with 80. While there have been military clashes causing higher losses of life since the end of the Korean War in 1953, South Koreans are reported to be shocked at this attack, because it was directed at a civilian-occupied area. Yeonpyeong is home to an active military population of about 1,000 Marines who patrol the waters surrounding the disputed northern limit line, a boundary North Korea does not officially recognize. The New York Times reports that 1,600 civilians also reside on the island and felt that it was adequately protected and safe, despite being only 8 miles from North Korea. North Korea defended the action, saying it was being provoked by South Korean military exercises that were underway and scheduled to continue for another week. The North accused the South of firing the first shots and crossing into northern-controlled waters. Choi Jin-wook of the Korea Institute for National Unification in Seoul said he thinks the attack was a response to sanctions that have denied food aid to the starving country. On Tuesday night, President Obama announced the U.S. will send an aircraft carrier accompanied by ships to the region while South Korea continues its military exercises. My guest is Thomas P. Kim. He is the executive director of the Korea Policy Institute and professor of politics and international relations at Scripps College. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi, Sonali.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of this logic that the fire from North Korea could be a response to sanctions that have cut U.S. food aid to that country?
Well, certainly I think it's consistent with the idea that when you ratchet up tension, when you ratchet up pressure on North Korea, and certainly sanctions is one example of this, that frankly that simply doesn't work. It certainly hasn't worked around the world in any number of cases. It doesn't work in North Korea. The response from the North Koreans has actually been very consistent when you have this kind of thing, which is that they in fact seek to respond with some sort of measure. It's always been a tit for tat with North Korea, and has been for some 20 odd years. Let me give you one concrete example of this, which hopefully in the context later on we'll figure out just exactly what happened now. But we have the benefit of hindsight as scholars. We can look back and see, as an example, the way that North Korea typically responds. Now, back in 2006, the U.S. targeted North Korea's access to international financial transactions. They essentially were trying to isolate it from the global market. So North Korea at that time, they boycotted the six-party talks. Now, in response to this, besides boycotting, North Korea typically also tries in some way to reach out to try and let the U.S. know, to let the U.S. and South Korea know, but especially the U.S. because really the key issue is peace with the U.S. The North Koreans reached out. Lee Gun of the North Korean Foreign Ministry actually went to the U.S., which is a big deal at that time, to propose a bilateral mechanism. And if they wanted to, if the U.S. wanted to resolve this sort of issue of money laundering that the U.S. Was accusing, the North Koreans actually offered to open an account at Citibank so that the U.S. could properly acknowledge and monitor this. Now, the U.S. said no at that time. The North Koreans asked for a bilateral meeting with Christopher Hill, who was the special envoy at that time, and the U.S. also said no, and that was when the North Koreans finally launched missiles back in July of 2006. Now, unfortunately, that didn't lead at that time to people going to the bargaining table. Instead, it led to the U.S. going to the U.N. looking for international sanctions, and so the response there was that the North Koreans actually tested the nuclear device back in October 9th of 2006. So this is a very consistent response. It was only when, actually, Christopher Hill violated his instructions from Condoleezza Rice and actually held a bilateral meeting with the North Koreans did the North Koreans actually come back to the bargaining table. So I think that what you're seeing is, in part, is potentially, and we'll know later on for sure, but certainly there's a certain consistency in response to efforts by South Korea or by the U.S. to escalate. And it bears pointing out also that that this isn't the first time, just to put some context in for your listeners, the Lee Myung-bak government, the South Korean government at this time, they came into a situation where they, Lee is quite conservative, and he came into a situation when he was elected, platforming, he ran on a platform being very, very harsh and very tough on North Korea. And from the beginning, he really has sought to roll back all the gains that were made under the administrations, the prior two administrations, including that of Kim Dae-jung, who, of course, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to bring peace to the peninsula.
What about the sense, some are saying in the media, that these actions from North Korea are also potentially calculated aggression to signal the transfer of power that's happening between Kim Jong-il and his son Kim Jong-un?
Frankly, I think that, to be really blunt about it, I think that they're just guessing. They don't really have any idea what they're talking about. It's almost impossible to know what's going on in North Korea with regard to those sorts of issues. But the only thing that you can say is this. You've had three major North Korean leaders since the founding of the state. The first leader, Kim Il-sung, was clearly, and I think there's very little debate about this, he was clearly dearly beloved by the North Korean people. And by all accounts was someone that had just wielded tremendous authority. Kim Jong-il, who we mindlessly, I think, in the West, think that is you know, going to be exactly the same or play exactly the same role as his father, he clearly had less power than Kim Il-sung. And after all, that makes sense because, after all, Kim Il-sung, he was a revolutionary leader from the 1930s. He fought off Japanese colonialism. He presided over decades of prosperity, peace and prosperity in North Korea. And he was replaced by his son at a time in 1994 when North Korea really was on the skids. And so from the standpoint of the Korean people in the North, I think, and as well as just in terms of internal politics, it makes a lot of sense that Kim Jong-il actually has less power than Kim Il-sung, and he's simply not as loved and not as respected. Kim Jong-un, of course, has virtually no track record. He's probably potentially in a worse situation than Kim Jong-il, and I think one of the things that's being masked by the Western media is that certainly, while Kim Jong-un will be in name the power, there's and certainly will be a powerful figure, I think that you're going to continue to see a trend in North Korea, which is less consolidation of power around a single person, more negotiation with different folks. And this is actually important in part because despite our Western monolithic view of what's going on in North Korea, there are, in fact, people who are moderates, and there are people who are hardliners. And every time we in the West, or every time that the South Korean government, conservatives in the South Korean government, push hard to confront and put North Korea into a corner, the hardliners get empowered, and the moderates, the ones that actually are seeking pushing even harder and harder but are being drowned out in the cacophony of military voices that you're hearing at times like now, those folks are being pushed back into the background.
My guest is Thomas P. Kim. He is the executive director of the Korea Policy Institute and a professor of politics and international relations at Scripps College. And we're talking about the situation between North and South Korea right now. Just yesterday, they exchanged major fire, putting governments across the world on edge. Now, Thomas Kim, there is also speculation that this attack was planned by the North as a follow-up to its revelation of a nuclear facility that was unknown until recently when it invited a group of American scientists to see the new plant. The North Koreans said they had 2,000 centrifuges installed and running, and Siegfried Hecker, who's a Stanford professor, said he was stunned by the sophistication of the facility and the control room. What do you think?
I think that it's a very important development, and certainly from the North Korean side, I imagine that part of what's going on is that they feel a little bit more secure and a little bit more confident about their security in the context of potentially having a more expanded nuclear weapons program than they had previously let on. But I think that also the really critical thing here, the really critical issue, that unfortunately it's so hard to get perspective sitting over here and being fed what we are fed by mainstream media and by commercial media in the U.S. It's so hard to get perspective on what's going on. And what's going on in the broadest sense of the last 20-odd years is that the North Koreans have consistently sought to try and establish some sort of diplomatic framework so they can get to normalized relations with the United States. That was coming out of the Cold War when the Kim Il-sung leader at that time figured out that it was actually critical for the movement forward of the North Korean people to establish some sort of diplomatic relations with not just with the U.S. but with everyone else, but realizing that without the U.S., without getting the U.S. on board, the North Koreans were going to be in a situation where they're being constantly isolated by the U.S., by their enemies, and also And this is another big thing, which unfortunately is never talked about, that the North Koreans would become increasingly reliant on China. Now, we read in the Western media, we read about how the Chinese are protecting the North Koreans, about how the North Koreans are really presumably thankful for the Chinese, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is, of course, that this fundamentally misunderstands the nature of the North Korean state, which is that it's a state that is really just tremendously focused on its sovereignty, on its self-determination. It's a state that was founded out of the crucible of U.S. imperialism after World War II. It's the first site of the Cold War. It's one of the first places where the U.S. came in and tried to impose a government. The U.S. divided Korea at that time after World War II as a means of fighting the Cold War. And it's out of all of this that the North Korean state has emerged. It's fundamentally a state that is focused on self-determination. And so in that context, when people talk about how thankful they might be of China, I have to say that myself and a lot of other scholars, we just kind of laugh at this, although unfortunately not in a happy way, because really what they want is they want to depend less on China. And one of the critical ways that they see that happening is by engaging with the U.S. and bringing the U.S. into a relationship with it. Now, that's been going on. Their effort to engage with the U.S. has been going on for 20-odd years. And the paradox, I think, for a lot of people is something like this. If North Korea is looking to engage with the United States, then why do they engage in some sort of military attack or provocation? And the answer for that is twofold. First of all, what's going on in part with a lot of these situations is that they're responding to something concrete that has happened, and they feel the need, especially as a state that's so determined for its sovereignty, they feel the need to respond. Now, the specific situation here would be that you have this disputed maritime border, which the North Koreans never agreed to. It was imposed by the United Nations at a time when the North Koreans actually did not belong to the United Nations, so they've never agreed to the border. Here you've got 70,000-odd South Korean troops, along with some U.S. Troops, having exercises, firing artillery, and I noticed that in the media, it disingenuously said that the shells are being fired to the west. Well, if you look on a map, you can see that North Korea sticks out, and so if you're firing at the west, you're firing basically in the direction of North Korea at that time. So I don't know where the shells landed, but the point is that you have a situation where the South Koreans are engaged in major military exercises. North Koreans have repeatedly asked them not to do that, and now today you're reading about how well the North Koreans waited for 4 hours, and so it's clearly not that they were worried about being attacked. That's not really the point. The point is that what you're seeing is, again, you're seeing a standard tit for tat. You hit me, I'll hit you. You scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. Whenever the U.S. reaches out in some sort of diplomatic way, or the South Koreans try to, in a meaningful, in an honest diplomatic way, because there is a distinction there, the North Koreans tend to respond. And so that's just something that's very consistent. So that's the first part. But the broader issue with regard to why they respond militarily, what appears to be military, when in fact they're looking for peace, is because they're really trying to force the U.S. to negotiate with it. And again, this is a I'm sorry, I'm taking a little bit long with this answer, but it's really important to point out that, again, the Western media completely misses something, which is they talk about how North Korea is trying to get a big buy-off, how they're trying to get a big bribe. Those are all things that might be important, but really are just they're shadows of what North Korea actually really wants to have, well, which is a meaningful diplomatic relationship with the U.S.
Well, finally, then, briefly, let's talk about the significance of President Obama's reaction to send an aircraft carrier to, I suppose, buttress South Korea's military exercises. How is that going to be seen by the North, and could this escalate into war, as some mainstream media outlets are speculating?
It's unfortunate, but it's not going to escalate. I would be highly doubtful it's going to escalate into war. I don't see anyone wanting to have war at this time. And I think by the initial reactions that you saw from everyone, the effort to tamp down the possibility of escalation. So I'm not so worried about that. I do think, however, that the fact that there's this huge, massive aircraft carrier going toward North Korea right now highlights a very important issue, which I expect will get more play very soon. And that is that I always tell people that if North Korea was sitting on the border or on the edge of Antarctica or South America or someplace that wasn't so geopolitically important, the U.S. would have arrived at peace with North Korea a long time ago. But it's not. If you look at a map, North Korea's northern borders are Russia and China. So what you have is you have a major, massive aircraft carrier trucking its way over to North Korea, and the Russians and the Chinese are getting more and more anxious and nervous about this. Mm-hmm. And so it highlights just how important it is geopolitically, and it also highlights why it's so difficult to actually get to some kind of peace with the North Koreans and the United States, and just to get to unification, which is really where we want to go with this from the standpoint of ordinary Koreans. So we'll see what happens there. And I just wanted to get one last quick point in, which is, again, really important. We spend so much time in the West, especially after incidents like this, talking about how, all the conversation is about men with military power and guns. And it's really unfortunate because this really it masks the fundamental issues here, which is you still have, some 10 million odd families that have been separated by the Korean War, by division that was caused by the U.S. back in 1948. Excuse me. Well, technically it would have been 1944. Anyway, but the point is you've got 10 million families. You've got just tremendous heartbreak on both sides, and so every time something like this happens, we take away focus from the actual real humanitarian issues involved, the actual real suffering of ordinary Koreans. And it just moves toward, this conversation that somehow we think that the military is going to be the solution there, and it's not. One thing we have not tried is diplomatic engagement with North Korea. So we're still waiting for that to happen.
Thomas Kim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your analysis.
Thank you so much.
Thomas P. Kim is the executive director of the Korea Policy Institute and a professor of politics and international relations at Scripps College.